Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. In the first quarter of 2021, U.S. homicides increased by nearly 25% from the same period in 2020 and 49% from the same time in 2019. Murders in Philadelphia are up 38% from this time last year, and there are over 100 more than in 2019. There have been more murders in Philadelphia this year than in New York City, even though New York's homicides have increased as well. It's not just large cities either. Homicides are up nationwide. The proliferation of guns is being pointed to as one of the reasons, but not the only factor during this most unusual of times over the past 15 months. On today's program, we'll look at guns and crime overall. In the first segment of today's program, we're joined by Dr. Cassandra Crafassi, Deputy Director of the Center for Gun Violence Prevention and Policy with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Crafassi, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Crafassi, you have described the rise in gun violence the last 13 months as a perfect storm. In what way?
So as we saw the start of the pandemic in early 2020, I think many people assumed that with the stay-at-home orders, we may have seen a decrease in violence as fewer people were out and about. But what happened, unfortunately, is that the pandemic exacerbated all of the issues that were already in place that were contributing to rises in violence. We saw increased unemployment, social stresses, economic and emotional stresses, and all of these tensions came together along with social unrest related to the murder of George Floyd, and just really exacerbated these existing conditions in many of our communities of color that have concentrated disadvantage, leading to some of these increases that we're seeing in violence.
Now, you know, there have been some who have pointed out that these are unprecedented times when you're talking about a pandemic, a once in a century pandemic. And when you're also talking about the social unrest, the criminal injustice, racial injustice, I should say, protest over the last year. Is there any signs that once things get back to normal, whether who knows what normal is, that these shootings, these murders will go down?
Unfortunately, without some real changes at the local, state, and national level, I don't think we're going to see a decline. Crime rates, homicide rates had been at a fairly stable low in the 2000s until 2014, when we saw an increase in homicide that has sustained, and now we're seeing increases. It's important to note that overall crime has declined over the last couple of years. It's really violent crime, and in particular homicide, that's been increasing. Some folks have pointed to more guns being available, spikes in gun sales, which certainly is important. We need to think about access to guns, but we also need to think about why people feel like they need guns. What's happening in these communities that's driving demand? What's happening to make people feel like a gun is the thing that they need to keep them safe, to resolve disputes, et cetera? And we need a really comprehensive plan that focuses on identifying and stemming streams of guns into these communities. But we also need sufficient and sustained investment in community violence interruption and also the communities themselves so that people don't have that demand for guns.
As you said, what the pandemic did, and if we could also include the social unrest of last year, what it did was it really highlighted a lot of the inequalities that we have and the issues that existed before in some communities with poverty, with access to resources, those kind of things. Police reform is another issue that what I'm getting at is when I asked the question whether, you know, there is any end in sight or at least a reduction, is those are things that are just not going to turn around overnight, even with, you know, efforts by the Biden administration, the federal government, even on the state and local level. Those are things that existed beforehand and would seem to be very difficult to turn around overnight.
Exactly. And while it might seem like this spike in gun violence and homicide happened overnight, we didn't get here overnight. We have decades, if not centuries, of policies of systematic disinvestment, of concentrating disadvantaged and low-income communities in a situation where they don't have access to resources. And at the end of the day, violence is a symptom of that disinvestment. We need to think about how people have educational equity, economic opportunities with true gainful employment, an actual quality job. And when people go into the criminal justice system and come home, we need to make sure that they have the supports and resources so that they can be successful. We need to think about the everyday trauma that people are experiencing, even as children witnessing violence in these communities. And until we take a holistic approach where we are really wrapping these communities in needed services, making sustained and sufficient investments, we're really not going to start to see a solution. We can't arrest our way out of this, which is what we've tried to do in the past and failed.
If you're just tuning in on today's program, we're talking about, well, I hate to use the word uptick because it's been more than an uptick. It has been a fairly substantial, significant increase in the number of homicides across this country. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Cassandra Kerfassi. She's deputy director of the Center for Gun Violence Prevention and Policy with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Coming up a little later in the program, we're going to hear from Jeff Asher, who is a data analyst and co-founder of AH Datalytic that studies crime statistics, and we'll talk specifically about the homicides. Let's break down some of these factors, Dr. Kerfassi. Let's start with the proliferation of guns. In 2020, Americans purchased more than 23 million guns, a 66% increase over 2019 sales. Now, that's a trend that has continued into 2021. Now, it seems logical if there's more guns, it would mean more shootings. Does your research back that up?
So there's a large body of research documenting the relationship between access to firearms and injury and death. Guns are exceptionally lethal, whether it's harming someone else or harming oneself. I do want to note that the leading cause of gun-related death in the U.S. is suicide, and it's particularly concerning because we know out of some research out of California that there is an increased risk of suicide shortly after acquiring guns. So this is something that we are certainly keeping an eye on. The other alarming thing in my mind, looking at the trend in gun purchasing, is how many people were first-time gun purchasers. We have so many folks between, you know, depending on the estimate, 25 to 35% of people who bought guns in 2020 were first-time gun purchasers. These are people who might not know how to safely store them, safely handle them, how to use them. And so thinking about the additional risk these guns in the home might pose, particularly if they're children or teens who may be at risk of finding those firearms. And then the other concern is, what do folks do with those firearms when the concern passes, right? A lot of people may have purchased guns because of the pandemic, because of social unrest. And when those things, not that they're going to go away, but as those concerns ebb slightly, are they going to be engaged in responsible sales practices and making sure that those guns only get into the hands of people who should have them? The last thing, thinking about so many guns being available now, we know that theft can be a common source. off straw purchasing as well, you know, people getting guns from friends or family members, but certainly with more guns around in cars, in homes, et cetera, they're ripe for theft if they're not stored properly, which can lead to more guns being available on our streets for use in crime.
All right. So let's, I want to follow up on that a little bit with the record number of legal gun sales. Are the murders and shootings from guns that were legally purchased, were they committed by the people who bought them legally, or is it a result of straw purchases or gun thefts? In other words, are the shootings occurring, the people committing these shootings, were they the people who legally bought more guns?
That's a really great question. Unfortunately, as researchers, we don't have access to that information that was blocked by the TIART amendments that were passed through Congress. So researchers can't get access to crime gun trace data to answer those questions. But I will say folks who are lawfully purchasing guns, who undergo a background check, are probably less likely to be using those guns to harm others. But the problem with lots of guns around, they originate in legal sales, right? Guns aren't growing on trees. And so it's not like guns are just magically appearing in our markets, in underground markets. The problem is guns start in lawful sales and then they may get lost or stolen. Someone may sell someone or give a gun to a friend that may use that gun. And so it's really about this large number of guns that are available and making sure that we are engaging in responsible storage practices and sales practices so guns don't fall into the hands of people who shouldn't have them.
We will say that accidental shootings and children getting possession of a gun that's in a household, that those numbers have increased over the last year and a half as well. Suicides, we don't know for sure because those numbers are not put out there in real time. Last week, President Biden outlined a 5-point plan. Most of it had to do with gun violence. Let me just quickly run through these. Make it easier to revoke the licenses of gun dealers who violate federal law, plus add resources to ATF. Allow communities expecting a summer surge in crime to use funds from the American Rescue Plan, the COVID relief bill passed in March, to hire officers up to pre-pandemic levels, invest in technology and boost community policing, especially in order to fight gun violence. Invest in community-based intervention programs for both potential perpetrators and potential victims of gun violence. Through ARP funds, expand summer programming, employment opportunities, and other forms of support for teens and young adults, such as food and housing assistance, and help returning citizens adjust, find housing, and find work after leaving prison, including through new funds announced by the Department of Labor this week. So, Dr. Krafas, in your opinion, what the president has outlined there, will it have an impact?
I think it's a good start. So one of the most important and challenging aspects of gun violence is that there is no single solution. Everything that we can do is going to help us move the needle. So whether we're focusing on the supply side, holding accountable people who are selling firearms irresponsibly is so important because we know from prior data that a very small number of licensed dealers were responsible for a large proportion of guns that were recovered in crime. Either they weren't conducting background checks or they were knowingly engaged in straw purchase where the person buying the gun was not the person who was going to use it. So holding these people accountable, these people who can sell firearms, is a really important place to start. I also appreciate the comprehensive approach of this plan, which focuses not just on these community violence intervention programs, which are really important to interrupt cycles of violence, mediate dispute, help connect people with social services, but also investing in the communities through summer jobs programs, ensuring that people who are reentering our communities after time in the criminal legal system have the tools and the skills that they need to be successful. Far too often, people who have engaged in violence and have served time in prison or jail return to their communities in very much the same circumstances that led them to engage in violence in the first place. So taking this holistic approach providing them with the services that they need to reintegrate, as well as focusing on the sources of guns, it's a good first step. It's not the end all be all, but at least it's setting us on a path toward the right direction.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The nation's crime rates have been going down over most of the past two decades. No one really has been able to answer why. Actually, property crimes, as Dr. Crafassi mentioned, have declined over the past 18 months, but the increased number of murders is what has so many people on edge. What's happening that is contributing to the rising number of homicides? Joining in our conversation is Jeff Asher. He's a data analyst and co-founder of AH Datalytic, also was a crime data analyst with the New Orleans Police Department. Mr. Asher, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we will continue to have Dr. Crafassi on the program, and I encourage you, Dr. Crafassi, to join in our conversation as well. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. If you'd like to send an email, send it to smarttalk@witf.org. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, we may have some repetition here, but I just wanted to get your opinion, Mr. Asher, as well. We talked about the role of guns and some of the other factors. What do you find as some of the factors that are leading to this big increase in the number of murders across the country?
I mean, I guess if I were to go into it, I'd basically repeat everything Dr. Crafassi said. I think she hit the nail on the head pretty squarely. It's a complicated thing to really look at the cause of it, because I don't think there's one cause. I think there's lots of smaller causes. And the reason I think that is just going back through the evidence of when murder was up and why. And so if you look at the data from the FBI, we know that murder was elevated for the first half of the year. So really before the protests, before last summer, murder was up somewhere between 7% and 15% in the cities that reported preliminary data to the FBI. And then it really shot up over the summer in a lot of cities. And you talk about New York or Philadelphia or Chicago, that these cities that had these huge surges in violence that began really in early June and corresponded with the protests against police violence after the death of George Floyd. And I think the challenge there is in understanding what is the cause there, because it's not the protests. There were lots of places where there were protests and there was no violence. Most places where there was protest, there was no violence. And we know that last year's murder rise was so enormous and was so widespread that it wasn't just protests in Portland that explained the increase everywhere. So there was this dramatic increase. It took place at the same time as the protests against police violence. It took place at the same time as this crisis in police legitimacy, as it's called, where if people don't trust the police, they may be less likely to participate in the criminal justice system. And then it occurred at the same time as depolicing in a lot of places that have data, where there was this decrease in arrests, decrease in stops. And that, I think, is also complicated. You also had a lot of officers leaving the departments that we're seeing, although we don't really know how much departments shrunk last year. You had all of these factors happening at the same time, and then it continued through the fall. And so really it speaks to this sort of cycle of retribution that's really difficult to interrupt and is difficult to bring down. And so I think that when you talk about why it occurred, you have to sort of put all of these things together. It might have been initially the stresses of the pandemic and then turned into a police legitimacy crisis and then turned into just a gun violence crisis, although I guess it was a gun violence crisis all along. And to your point earlier about record gun sales, we know that there were lots of guns on the streets. I had a piece in Vox a couple of weeks ago that talked about using arrest and stop data in 10 cities that showed in April, May timeframe, so before the surge in murders, there was clearly an increase in gun carrying based on the percentage and the number of guns that police officers were taking off the streets and arrests, while you had arrests falling because of quarantines and COVID, but the number of guns being taken off was increasing, suggesting that before all of this, you had this big surge in gun carrying, which wasn't necessarily a cause of the increase in violence, but I like to think of it sort of as an accelerant. It was something that kept it going and made what might have been a normal crisis into a historically large increase in murder.
And I want to break down some of the factors that both you and Dr. Crefassi mentioned. I just read a column over the weekend by one of the chief of police associations across the country. Said that we went too quickly with criminal justice reform. That's one of the reasons that we have seen this uptick in the number of murders, that there are some people who probably should not have been left out of jail that were released into society. Something else that you just mentioned, since the George Floyd murder and the protest, I mean, anecdotally, and probably you have the data to back this up, we have seen fewer arrests or police officers that are less likely to maybe pull someone over or make an arrest. They don't want to be caught on a video, making an arrest. We go along with that, and this is more of a future question, but we're hearing stories about police departments having trouble recruiting new people, and makes me wonder whether the people who will be recruited, maybe have potential to be not as good of police officers. So that's kind of the police reform aspect of this. Jeff, what do you think?
So I'm a skeptic of all of that being causally related for a couple of reasons. One, just looking big picture, New Orleans, where I'm from, went from 60,000 arrests per year in 2010 to 15,000 in 2019. And it also went from a murder rate that was 40 or 50 per 100,000. It basically cut its murder rate in a quarter between 2011 and 2019, such that in 2019, the city recorded its fewest murders that it had ever had. So New Orleans very successfully reduced its jail population, reduced arrests, and reduced the number of murders. New York is a very similar situation, where in 2010 it had 35,000 arrests per month, and in 2019 it was averaging 15,000 arrests per month. It saw no increase in violence. It saw no increase in murders. And it actually saw a decrease in New York at the same time as arrests and violence and the jail population being lowered to historically low rates. So I think that's one reason to be skeptic, that all of a sudden this decrease in arrests and decrease in policing, which has been happening for most of a decade in a lot of big cities, suddenly that's the cause of the increase. The other reason I'm skeptical is that there was a big decrease in arrests and stops in March and April. We know in pretty much every city that has arrests and stops data that's available, you see the exact same pattern, which was this big drop in March and April and no increase in violence. And so obviously people were quarantined, but the takeaway for me at least is that the stops and arrests dropping alone was not causally the decrease. It wasn't just that the arrests and stops dropped that would lead to it. I mean, arrests in New York went from 15,000 to 8,000, which is a big drop relative to in February to June, but isn't a big drop relative to when they were going 35,000 a month just a few years prior. So I'm kind of rambling on this because I think that it's a complicated concept. And I think makes sense to people, but I don't think that it makes sense for why people suddenly just started on a dime shooting each other, because police in communities where largely clearance rates are pretty low to begin with, all of a sudden police stopped making a handful of arrests and stops, similar to what they've been doing for the large part of the last decade.
I know I'm jumping around on the two of you here with some of these questions, and I do want to get to our listeners' questions as well. But, in my introduction, I mentioned that, crime rates have been down for the past 20 years. And really, there have been a lot of people who have tried to explain why. Jeff Asher, do you have a theory on why crime fell over the past 20 years?
No, I mean, I think that's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? Some of it may be better policing, better societal growth, better economy. I'm not really one that looks into sort of those big picture questions, and so I think it's very important, but I really don't have a lot of answers on exactly why that happened. And Dr. Kafasi may have better answers on that one.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, that if we could answer with certainty, we could employ some of those same tools now to continue moving things down. I will say we have had a number of communities that were experiencing high rates of violence in the late 90s and early 2000s that employed the same kinds of community-based violence prevention programs then that the president has been talking about now. Oakland, for example, is a place that has seen huge successes working with law enforcement, working with impacted communities. And so that's potentially one example, but being able to target even one or a handful of things that are responsible for the huge declines, I think depending on who you ask, you might get different answers.
And again, just going to repeat what both of you have said, is that actually during this surge in murders, that property crimes have declined. So if you look at the overall crime rate, it is not up that high, if it's up at all. It's just where we've had the significant increase in the number of shootings and number of murders. Bob has a question, and Dr. Krafas, I'm going to put this to you because you mentioned this earlier. He said, you mentioned that information is not available due to a law blocking the release of shooting information research that has been blocked by Congress. Can we or could we get more on what kind of information is blocked by what law and what can be done to withdraw that law?
Absolutely. So it's called the TEART Amendment. And what it did is back in the late 1990s, researchers gained access to individual crime gun data. So when a gun is recovered in crime, it has a serial number, law enforcement would submit that to the ATF, which would trace the gun back to the original gun shop who sold it, the original purchaser, etc. And that information can be used to trace it back to the person and see if the person who bought the gun was the person who used it in a crime. And that's the data that was used that I mentioned earlier that identified a very, very small percentage, less than 5% or so of gun dealers in the U.S., were responsible for more than half of the crime guns that were recovered. So that data was used in some lawsuits. It was used to encourage changes to sales practices. And those gun shops saw drops in their crime gun recoveries such that they were no different from any other gun shop. Then in 2002, as reported, it was said that it was done to make it a little bit easier for the Representative Tiart's colleagues who were gun dealers, to sell their guns. They blocked the release of that data. So now law enforcement still has that data, although I think Mr. Asher can probably speak to this a little bit better than I can. They don't always have the capacity to do the kind of analyses that researchers can do to sort of look at some of the bigger picture things, because our law enforcement agencies and officers are often responding to crime. They don't always have the capacity to kind of take a step back. And so we lost that ability to say, where are these crime guns coming from? Who's driving their release into some of our underground markets? And so this amendment could be repealed if it was decided by our elected officials that was a priority. I think one of the most important pieces about this whole thing is just access to high quality data. If we don't have data, it's hard for us to know whether our policies are effective, where these guns are coming from, so that we can effectively design interventions. And it's just a big gap.
I mean, just to, if I could editorialize for just a moment, one of the dumbest things out there, I have to say that, when you have thousands of people being killed and you can't do research on it. Jeff Asher, a lot of what we hear is anecdotal. For example, I often hear that Chicago, that many of the weapons used for shootings and killings in Chicago were purchased in Indiana, straw purchases, but brought from Indiana into Chicago that has more stringent gun laws. New York, also hear that a number of purchases, a lot of purchases made in states that don't have as stringent gun laws as New York and then brought into New York. You're a data analyst. How much good data do you have? And are those anecdotes, do they hold up?
I remember I spoke to a reporter who once had a great quote about how basically every crime story is one about bad data. We have data and it tells us things, but we don't have quality enough data to really answer the most important questions. And so we know that a little less than half of Illinois firearms are recovered from other states, with Indiana producing about 12% of those. So we know that a lot of the firearms that are being used in Chicago are probably coming from Indiana or coming from other states, but we don't really have, at least publicly, the data to really understand these networks and to do in any sorts of real time. With the ATF data, we're talking about data from 2019 as our most recent data, and it's not really at the granular level enough for the public to be able to make any sorts of policy decisions or understand the effectiveness of enforcement programs. To what Dr. Crafasi was saying, that it is a real issue even within police departments, the ability to, one, recover guns, and two, to then trace them. You need the crime labs, you need the ability to actually do the traces, and then to be able to connect them, you need advanced data systems and the ability to interact with agencies, because obviously guns don't stop at state borders just because they're city borders, just because their borders are there. And you need the analytic capability to really match that. And there are a handful of cities that do that and a handful of police departments that can do that. But for the most part, it's not really something that most places excel at. And so I think it makes it very difficult to understand how illicit firearms are being used, where they're coming from, how guns are being passed throughout a city. And ultimately, if you can't understand those things, it makes it really difficult to interject and to stop these processes from happening.
I'll ask that same question that I asked of Dr. Crafasi earlier. Is there evidence that the increase in the number of shootings, the increase in the number of murders using a firearm, that this big increase in the number of legally purchased guns, that they're being committed by the people who actually bought those guns? Or is it that those guns somehow fell into the wrong hands, people who were not supposed to have them?
We have no evidence one way or the other. My gut would tell me that it's more of the latter, that you have a big surge in gun sales. And when you're talking about murder, you're talking about actually a really low base rate. You're talking about 0.2% of all crime, all major crime as reported by the FBI is actually murder. So it wouldn't take a huge influx in the number of guns. If you have X million gun sales in a year, it wouldn't take a huge number of those to be left in cars, to be left open, to be given to somebody that's then stolen, and those being used in crimes to really make a big difference. And so we don't have data one way or another. I don't know that we'll ever get data on that. We might get some data from the FBI, from the ATF, that will allow for some roundabout assessments of whether or not there was a change in who was using guns or what the types of guns that were used in crimes. But we'll never, at least as far as I'm aware, be truly able to answer that type of a question.
So you're
One
not
important piece of
ahead,
data, if I could just jump in for a moment,
sure.
Which is when you ask individuals who are incarcerated for a crime with a gun, where they got that gun, very, very few of them legally bought them from a licensed dealer. Many of them got them through a straw purchase, so from a family member or a friend. Again, not the exact answer to the question that we all have, but at least it's giving us a sense, to Mr. Asher's point, that usually these guns are purchased legally and then are somehow making them into the hands of people who shouldn't have been able to buy them.
Mm-hmm. But Jeff Asher, I want to get back to something you just said. It doesn't sound like you're optimistic that Congress is going to change that law as to what research can be that is permitted.
Well, I can't, certainly can't speak to that. I don't know what Congress will do or don't, but I think that there is more research that's being conducted, and I don't know, you know, I don't know the degree to which it's a prohibition on research issue as a lack of solid data collection. To me, the biggest issue right now is that as a country, we don't track shootings. We track murders and we track aggravated assaults with a firearm, which can be shoot and miss, you know, beat up with a gun or shoot and wound. But we don't actually count the number of times that an individual shoots at someone else and hits them. And if you can't do that, knowing that 70, 80, 90% in some cities of all shootings are non-fatal, you're only tracking this tiny portion of gun violence, and it's going to be very difficult to ascertain trends and to better understand the level of gun violence nationally if you don't have a fuller understanding of all of the gun violence that's happening within communities.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest today, Dr. Cassandra Crafassi, who's Deputy Director of the Center for Gun Violence Prevention and Policy with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Jeff Asher, who is a data analyst and co-founder of AH Datalytic. He also was an analyst with the New Orleans Police Department. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the number of murders that have increased significantly. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We have a call from Maria in Lancaster, and I think Maria is, her question is related to what Jeff Asher just said about having good data on the number of shootings. Maria, you're on the air.
Hello. In Lancaster City, where I live, we've been having regular shootings. Houses have been shot at. The fronts of houses have been shot up. This has been happening regularly for months, and many of them do not get reported in news media at all. So a lot of people don't even know this is happening. I've been keeping notes on it myself because I'm concerned that these aren't even being reported. And so those that I find on social media where people have reported police are actually out on the scene, I'm keeping this a list of shootings myself, and I try to see if it's being reported, and I found many of them are not in any local TV or newspaper or media.
Hey, Maria, thank you very much for your observations, put it that way. Jeff Asher, the point she makes does kind of fall into line with what you were saying about shootings, not having good data on shootings. Quite frankly, if, you know, unless someone is hit, or there is an actual fatality, you often don't hear about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that, I think that Jennifer Doliak, an economist at Texas A&M, did research into what share of shootings where gunfire is actually reported to the police. And my understanding is that it was like a 20-to-1 ratio as far as for every 20 instances of gunfire where people are shooting into a house or shooting at one another or just shooting wildly into the air, only one of those is reported. And so you're going to see a large number of firearm discharges everywhere with very few of them leading to victims, very few of them even leading to the police being able to find casings and actually confirm that somebody did shoot bullets at someone else or into the air. And even fewer, a smaller percentage of those are going to be murders. And so even when we're talking about just tracking shooting victims, we're talking about tracking a small portion of the overall gunfire in any given city at any one point.
We've focused a lot on guns during this conversation, but both of you have mentioned that guns, that's just one factor in this. Jeff Asher, let me ask you about some of the others. Most of these shootings are occurring in areas where there's high rates of poverty. not a lot of access to resources. A lot of people of color involved in this. During the pandemic, many of those people, their jobs went away. Their incomes went down. What about all these things? And, I mean, these are things that existed before this increase in the number of murders. But it seems as though the pandemic, other factors have just helped it to exacerbate.
Yeah, as you said, I think that these are all factors that existed, but I think they're the types of factors that help to keep gun violence very concentrated. I mean, we know from lots of research that gun violence concentrates within communities and within geographic locations. And so these are also the same locations that are affected by poverty, by job losses, by economic downturns. And then there are also the places, there was a great series in the Washington Post a couple of years ago, looking at the geography of where police solve murders. The police solve shootings and murders in places like where I'm from, New Orleans. They solve murders in the French Quarter. Like 90-something percent of murders in the French Quarter are solved. And if you go a mile away or a mile and a half away to the 7th Ward, you get 10, 15% of murders being solved. And so that's something that we tend not to talk about as far as a major driver of gun violence, but it's the type of thing that I think helps to keep it concentrated in these very specific communities that are most affected by it.
We have a question from a listener wanting to know if gentrification of areas in historically high crime rates, if that's had an impact at, in some of these killings. Jeff, what about that?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the what?
The gentrification of areas with historically high crime rates, if there's been an impact in those areas.
I'm not certain. It's not something I looked into, but I'm guessing that sort of over decades it's had an effect. Dr. Kafasi may have a more nuanced answer on that one, though.
Dr. Kafasi?
Yeah, there's some evidence that has shown investment in communities sort of building up new economic enterprises and rehabbing homes can lead to reductions in violence. But to the listener's question's point, that can happen through gentrification, where you are driving out the individuals who had been living in that community. And so the violence reduction and the increases in health that you may see in those communities are not often experienced by the individuals who had been living there. And so the concern is, are you now displacing those individuals with the same concentrated disadvantage, same poverty, same unemployment, now to other areas of the city with the same lack of opportunity?
I mean, is it accurate to say that this increase is not just in cities? I mean, we focused a lot on the bigger cities just because of the sheer numbers. I mean, I have to say that it boggles my mind that Philadelphia has had more murders than New York City, you know, a city that is maybe one-tenth the size population of New York. But has there been an increase in the number of homicides in the suburbs and even the rural areas?
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, New York had more murders, or Philadelphia had more murders than New York last year, but it also had more murders than New York in 2019, 2018, and 2017
right,
as well.
Right.
So it wasn't just a new trend last year in Philadelphia. Nationwide, there was an increase. And the FBI put out preliminary data, quarterly data in March of this year for the end of 2021. About two-thirds of agencies reported data, and they found that murder was up at least 20% in cities of every size. So cities under 10,000, cities 100,000 to 250,000, and cities over a million, every one of them had murder up at least 20%. And then in the suburbs, in suburban counties, murder was up at least 15%. And then in rural counties, it was also up at least 15%. So to your point that we talk about Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, that's where most of the murders happen because most of the people live there. But last year there was a dramatic increase. It was historic and it was really incredibly widespread. And I think that when we talk about what the drivers were, that should influence our thinking that if it was just a Philadelphia or a Chicago thing, then we wouldn't have seen it everywhere. But we saw it everywhere, suggesting it was a bigger driver, or bigger drivers of the murder increase.
A couple more questions in the 4 minutes or so that we have left. Summer months, traditionally, we have seen more violence in the summer months. Could this get worse, or is it getting worse as the weather has heated up? Dr. Krafassi, let me start with you.
We do tend to see cycles of violence that increase in the warmer months. And so I think there is some sense of concern that things may get worse. I will say summer months can also provide opportunities like summer jobs programs, summer camps, other recreational activities. So if there is really sustained investment in those opportunities, it has the potential to mitigate some of those increases. But I do think folks who look at this data and follow it, we're all anticipating that there will be increases as we go further into the summer.
Jeff Asher, solutions. What can be done?
I think that's an excellent question. I think that there are no easy solutions. And I think that produces the challenge that the Biden administration clearly is facing, that it really is going to take years of effort and that you can't just flip a switch. This is not something that you can just deploy federal law enforcement to 15 different cities and have a surge, and then you'll see a decrease in violence. To Dr. Krafassi's points, I think investing in things like summer jobs programs, where we have evidence that they work, are likely to be the better solution. So the more money you can put into community programs, into community violence reduction, is most likely to be effective, even if there's no clear answer as far as exactly what places should be doing. I think if anybody had the answer, you know, you'd be billionaires by now, because it is such a difficult challenge. And it is something where, just because it works in one city, it may not work everywhere. Obviously, I think a lot of places lost law enforcement officers, lost police department, police officers. And we know that there's some relationship between the number of murders, or at least adding police officers can lead to murder reduction slightly. So reinforcing the number of police departments might be an option of something that places want to explore. Although obviously there are societal costs and benefits to growing and shrinking police departments that need to be considered. So it really is an investment in holistic programs that are community-based, are targeted at people that are most likely to be the victims of violence. And, you know, my pitch is always that since we don't really know exactly what works, it's smart to measure it. So, you know, rent yourself an economist and do some programs and try to if you're going to fail quickly and try the next thing, and keep investing in different types of programs, I think, is the only way to possibly find the ones that are most likely to be effective at reducing violence.
We only have about 30 seconds left. A lot of what you just mentioned has to do with the federal government. What is on the local and state levels? I've seen people say this is something that is going to have to be solved locally.
I think it all has to be solved locally. I think the federal government has the funding to make it possible to build up these programs and to do the measurements. But as far as the planning and implementing and handling of the programs, I think almost all of it has to be local. I think the federal government is going to have to sort of be a bystander as far as how things get implemented in a lot of ways.
Hmm. Jeff Asher is a data analyst and co-founder of AH Datalytic, and Dr. Krafassi, hold on just a second here. Dr. Cassandra Krafassi is deputy director of the Center for Gun Violence Prevention and Policy with Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. I want to thank both of you for your insights today. And hopefully, you know, some of these things will change and it won't be as bad as what a lot of people are expecting. But thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.